We're the ones that are going to be affected the most. This is our future. This is our planet.
That's Jess. She's 18, and she's far from the youngest protester at a recent youth climate strike at UMKC. Hundreds of people showed up, from really young kids with their parents to youngish millennials and a lot of in-between, meaning teens and people in their early 20s. This is Michelle. She's 20.
I think it's because the youth are going to be affected by climate change the most because we have to live, you know, we'll be alive in the next 12 years and we have to deal with those issues.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're starting today's show on KCUR's Central Standard with one of the organizers of that strike, Dawson Sims, age 20. He's a sophomore at UMKC, and he's in the studio with me now. Hi, Dawson.
Hi, Gina.
Tell me about last week's event. Who showed up, what it was like, how you felt about it.
We were really happy with the way that it went. It came together really quickly in about 3 weeks, really. The Student Environmental Coalition, which is environmental group on campus, we were approached by the Women in Science group, and they were like, hey, do you guys want to do this? We were like, yeah, we want to do this, but we weren't sure if anyone else was going to be interested, but we were really happy to see so much interest. We were able to form an alliance of different student groups, with YSI, Society of Physics students, a new group that we're starting called Fossil Free. We were really happy to bring all those student groups together. And then we reached out into the community to, for example, the Thomas Hart Benton group with the Sierra Club, 350 KC, the Climate Council of Greater Kansas City, Project Drawdown, all sorts of interest groups in the area were able to come out. And we were able to bring together more people than we expected. We were hoping for 50, 60 people, and we got almost 200. So we were really happy with the turnout.
What inspired you to want to, what are you striking when you have a strike against climate change? Mm-hmm. Are you shaking your fists at the atmosphere or?
No, it's not at the atmosphere. It's definitely going to be directed at, what we're protesting is government inaction on climate change. We want our leaders to have a plan. We want them to say that, hey, we recognize that this is a problem in the world. This is a problem for the futures of us, the young people of the world, the younger generations, and we want them to do something about it. We were really inspired by Greta Thunberg across the Atlantic Ocean over in Sweden. She's been the she initiated the first climate strike in Sweden, protesting outside of her parliament for the last 6 months, every Friday. And we've been inspired by that. And that movement's grown internationally to the point where more than a million, I think it was 1.6 million students participated around the world last Friday, which is great.
In general, do you get the vibe on campus at UMKC or just with friends beyond the school's boundaries that people your age are losing patience with older generations on this issue?
The clock is certainly ticking, for sure. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change from the UN, they released just last October a report that said that we need to cut our emissions pretty much in half by 45% by the year 2030. So in 11 years, we have 11 years to cut emissions in half, or the odds of extreme devastation from climate change increase dramatically. The odds of famine, drought, conflict, all of these things that are sort of peripheral, but then the direct effects like natural disasters and increased flooding, which we've actually seen, in the past week in Mozambique in Africa and here in the Midwest with the Missouri River flooding. So we see the signs, we hear the scientists, and we understand, and we want our leaders to understand as well.
Can you walk me through your personal journey to becoming an activist around climate change?
Yeah, it's happened really quickly in the last few months. I started out at UMKC as an undeclared student.
And as far as your major goes?
Yeah. Yeah, and then we moved into environmental studies in the last semester and found some existing groups on campus to get involved with, and we've just sort of grown from here as we've...
Who's we?
We. So friends that have been in the Student Environmental Coalition, Celestial Clark, she's the co-president there and also involved with Sierra Club, and then Geneva Tilbury and Shelby Dennis, they're in charge of Fossil Free.
This seems to me not the beginning of your journey, though. Like, how did you start feeling, like, taking this issue personally and feeling motivated to take action? And where were you at before then?
Well, sort of the big inspirations were coming, obviously, from Greta Thunberg, like I mentioned before, and then from watching the Sunrise Movement and their actions last November when they sat in at Nancy Pelosi's office asking for a select committee on the Green New Deal. I found that on Twitter, right? And that's sort of, I was like, hey, I want to do that. I want to get involved with that. And that's...
So seeing other young people taking action inspired you to think like, hey, I could do that.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Because if... me, the person that's learning about these issues as an environmental studies student, if I'm not going to do something about it, then who's going to be able to go out to the people and say, hey, here are the problems, here are the solutions? If it's not me and other students, then who's going to do it? It has to be somebody.
Has this issue always mattered to you, or is that new too? Not just, so there's one piece of it, which is becoming an activist about it, but there's the other piece of it, which is just that consciousness and awareness.
I feel like I've always had that consciousness. I can't really remember a time when I was like, this is the first time that I felt that climate change was an issue. We were sort of raised by it a little, raised understanding the issues, just people that I went to school with, like learning about it in
It's been
elementary
part of
school.
The conversation the whole time you've been alive, I guess.
Yeah, for sure it has. Like I guess one of the first memories I have was reading those like Scholastic Kids magazines in elementary school about Hurricane Katrina, and that's one of the earliest memories that I have in learning about that. Yeah.
What do you think effective activism looks like? I'm just sort of curious about what it means for someone your age to enact change. Or inspire change.
Yeah. So talking to our communities is a big part, and making sure that people understand the issue of climate change and other environmental issues. But then taking the next step, once you understand it, we also need to talk to our elected representatives. And with the Sunrise Movement, we've been working on doing that already.
So the Sunrise Movement is not just a Kansas City thing, but you've been involved in starting a Kansas City chapter.
Correct. Yeah. We've started a Kansas City Sunrise Hub. A friend of mine at UMKC, we sort of serendipitously found some people over in Johnson County that were doing the same thing. And we've grouped up. They visited with Sharice Davis's office. We visited with Emmanuel Cleaver's office. And we're just going to hope to keep that dialogue open with them and hopefully encourage them, convince them that they need to support a plan. We would prefer it to be the Green New Deal, but we want them to have a plan to address climate change.
Why is it called the Sunrise Movement?
That's a decent question. I'm not sure. I don't know if I have that answer.
Well, that's okay. Yeah. What do you think sets it apart from other environmental groups?
It's youth-led, for sure. There have always been youth involved, going back as old as the environmental movement back in the 60s, involved in these environmental movements. But this is youth being really actively engaged with the political process in a way that you don't always see, because there's sort of the narrative that young people might be apathetic to the political process
or naive
or something like that. Yeah.
Do you feel naive?
I don't think I'm I mean, I don't know if I'm the best person to
answer. Well, no, I mean, okay, I guess the real meaning of that question is you're someone who as a very young person is going to talk not just to like random grown-ups like your parents, friends or something. You're going to talk to elected officials about an issue that matters to you. The process of getting someone to listen, keep an open dialogue, that process is a challenge for anyone, and especially someone I would think who might be perceived as too young to get it or whatever. Yeah. How do you do it? How do you approach elected officials as a young person?
Just as myself, I guess. Like, everybody can approach, like, we have a right to talk to our representatives as constituents. Like, that's what we're supposed to do. That's how democracy is supposed to work. We're supposed to talk to our representatives and they're supposed to listen to us. It doesn't matter your age or any other aspect of who you are. They should be listening to you, and you should just tell your story however it is.
Dawson Sims, thank you so much for your time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Dawson helped organize a youth climate strike on the UMKC campus last week. He just shared his perspective on the growing movement for really young people to take this global issue into their own hands. Up next, something that is being done about climate change in Kansas City is urban reforestation. That means planting trees, and lots of them. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for that story. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And in the conversations we've had on this show about local responses to climate change and some of the most dire projections around climate change, one of the things that has jumped out as a sign of hope is a robust effort to plant trees. And that might sound like just a feel-good project or whatever, but we are not talking about planting a couple of trees here and there along a sidewalk. We're talking about a goal of planting how many trees a year, Tom Jacobs?
We're talking about planting about 15,000 trees a year over 25 years.
In Kansas City.
In Kansas City, Missouri.
That is a lot of trees.
It is a whole lot of trees. It's a moonshot almost, if you will.
So Tom Jacobs is the Environmental Program Director at MARC, the Mid-America Regional Council. And Tom, can you give me the history of how this particular project came about and where it stands now?
Certainly. There's been a longstanding recognition that trees just provide a huge number of benefits to the community. Some years ago, we did a study and we found that trees in our greater metro area provide about $320 million worth of value in terms of public health and clean air and clean water and energy conservation and habitat benefits and so forth. And as the understanding about climate change has ramped up, we've really understood that trees are, you know, the low-hanging fruit for dealing with the answer. And
what do you mean by that, low-hanging fruit?
Well, climate change is such a complicated problem, and we need to address it on so many different fronts. But trees just provide an incredible number of benefits, and they're things that we want to do anyway. They make our neighborhoods better, cleaner, more beautiful, but at the same time, they sequester carbon and provide all these other community benefits.
And you don't need, like, an international treaty to plant a tree.
Everybody plants trees in their yard, and the city plants trees along the streets, and we have trees in the parks. And all we're saying is if we have a few more and we take care of the ones that we have, our city will be better for it.
I definitely got the sense in our last conversation where there were plenty of people around the table who all really visibly lit up when the topic of urban reforestation came up. Why are the experts locally so excited about this?
It's incredible. So in Kansas City, Missouri, there's been a year-long process to formulate a tree master plan, and there were probably 100 people involved from all parts of the community. And everybody lights up because trees are beautiful. Everybody loves trees. And that might be for a lot of different reasons, but whatever the reasons are, it's a positive thing that anybody can do at their home or that the city can do at a larger scale.
So I want to bring in another voice on this. Joe Farzioni is the lead scientist for the Nature Conservancy. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
So what's your sense of the potential of urban forestation and the difference it can make when it comes to climate change, but also maybe some of the limits of how much can be done planting trees?
Yeah, as Tom said, everyone loves trees. And as you may recall from your high school biology class or Star Trek, life on Earth is carbon-based. And so trees and most plants are 50% carbon. So when we plant trees, we're taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting that into the tree. And this can add up. So most people might not realize that when you look globally, there's over four times as much carbon in plants and soil as there is in the atmosphere. And we've put, through plowing and paving, we've put about 133 billion tons of carbon in the atmosphere from plants and soil. And everything we can do to put some of that back in our plants and soil is good. And urban reforestation, as Tom mentioned, has a lot of co-benefits, and it's something that is, you know, everyone can get behind because there's so many benefits to having more trees in our cities.
So can you just back up, and as long as you've mentioned high school biology, you know, the term carbon footprint is sort of a buzzword, and we all know that we want to have a small one, but what is the role of carbon in this big picture, like climate change wise?
That's a great question. So when we put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and that is either from, you know, from burning fossil fuels or from losing forests or plowing up soils, that all puts carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which is a powerful greenhouse gas, and that helps trap heat, and that's what's behind global warming and climate change. So taking some of that carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it back into trees and plants helps fight climate change, and that's one of the ways to do that is through urban reforestation.
Can you explain the urban part of it? Like, how do you define urban reforestation? Because I've been saying this is just planting trees, but I'm perhaps oversimplifying.
Sure, when we think about reforestation, you might think about planting trees in, you know, some place after it's been clear-cut or burned. And urban reforestation really just is, you know, having more trees in the urban environment. And that's both through planting trees along streets, also in our parks, and also, and importantly, taking care of the trees that we have, because we have to protect them from pests and disease. And they're already storing a lot of carbon and providing a lot of benefits like filtering the air and increasing property values and helping people, you know, having access to green space also is well documented to help people relax and provide mental health and well-being benefits. So there's many benefits to trees, but keeping those trees we have and then planting more is what urban reforestation is all about. And we've done a study that shows across the country we could have room for about 8 million more acres of trees in all this if every city in America chipped in and undertook a plan like what Tom's talking about in Kansas City.
The part of reforestation is interesting to me too. I mean, is there a difference sort of impact wise when you think about planting trees in a place that maybe once had more of them versus planting them just because it's where we are? You know what I'm saying?
I think anytime you plant a tree it grows, it stores carbon. But urban reforestation or urban forestry in general is important because in many cities we have been losing trees, and it's just something that it's easy to take for granted and underinvest in, as trees die. If we don't have a strong, robust program to replant those trees, then over time, you know, you lose green space in your city.
Tom Jacobs, how does the plan you're proposing, like the very specific details of it, fit into what we're hearing from Joe? Because Kansas City does have its own story with tree loss and a whole history there.
Well, the plan that we're working on aligns perfectly with what Joe's talking about. Taking care of the trees that we have is a primary concern. The plan that was developed talks about a variety of things on the policy front. It talks about regulatory mechanisms or policy initiatives that could help protect what we have. The maintenance of existing trees is really important. So the city and most of our communities really are in a more reactive mode. So maybe a tree's losing limbs or has fallen down and somebody will call the city, call 311, and the city will take care of it. But to get in a proactive maintenance mode requires a substantial investment. And so the plan calls for ramping that up so that there's a regular maintenance cycle reduces liabilities, it improves the health of trees, it improves the longevity of trees. So that's really important. There's opportunities to fold urban forestry into a lot of different city initiatives. So it could be planting trees along streets. There's a significant effort to make the community more walkable, and so trees play a big part in that. The city
15,000 trees a year, though. I am really like trying to. 15,000 is a big enough number that my mind, just even as far as like how much space do 15,000 trees take up, the need for like the root space and everything. It seems crazy.
But at the same time, we've got a big city, right? And there's a lot of different spaces to plant. You can plant along a creek or a stream. We can plant in parks. People can plant in their front yard or their backyard. We can plant along streets. As new development happens, there's opportunities to use ecological design principles to enhance the environmental quality of those places while we seek to attain our economic development objectives. So there's plenty of land to do that. It is a big lift. The plan recognizes that maybe a third of those trees would be on public property, so the other two-thirds, roughly 10,000 trees a year, would need to occur on private lands. And so in order to achieve this large goal, it really will require a lot of partnerships and community support to try and figure out all the places and ways that this could happen.
Does that 15,000 number come from like qualitative data about carbon or about just land use in Kansas City?
It's quantitative data, actually. It wasn't rooted in an analysis about carbon sequestration potential. We did an inventory of the trees in the city and found that we have roughly a 32% canopy coverage. And we talked about what goal might we want to set. And there are some communities in the country that maybe have a 40% canopy coverage. But to get that far was too big of a lift for us. And we thought, well, maybe we can get to 35%. And so when we did the math, it came out to about 15,000 trees a year.
So, Joe, there does seem to be some scientific consensus that we need to limit global warming to, what is it, 2 degrees Celsius or less? Is that right?
That's correct.
So what needs to happen for that to come about? You've written that land stewardship is a big part of what we need, but that it's poorly understood in the U.S. Can you explain that and how it relates to planting trees?
Sure. I think it's important to note that planting trees and taking care of our lands, it's an important part of solving climate change, but it has to happen in addition to a rapid transition to zero carbon energy. And so the climate crisis is urgent enough that we need sort of an all hands on deck approach. And that means investing in that energy transition, but also in natural climate solutions like planting trees. And that's just, planting trees is perhaps the the most prominent, but there are many others. Also building soil health in our agriculture lands, which is another kind of low-hanging fruit because it's win-win. And also avoiding conversion of forests and grasslands helps keep that carbon in place. So
when you say avoiding conversion of particularly grasslands, mm-hmm. you're talking about new construction, new development, essentially, right?
Yeah, we're losing roughly 1 million acres of grassland a year in the country to expansion of cropland. And part of that is due to when cities expand into cropland and you lose cropland to that urban sprawl, you need to make that up by having cropland elsewhere. So that's going into our prairies. And, that's some of our last remaining grassland habitat needs to be protected, and doing that helps keep that carbon in the soil.
So,
and that happens through by keeping, in general, most of that grassland is rangeland, so that means keeping sustainable, productive ranches on our grassland.
And Tom Jacobs, you want to jump in here?
I did. I appreciated your question about stewardship, and I really enjoyed your interview with the previous guest, Dawson, and sometimes it boils down to just caring about the natural resources, whether it's a forest or a river or a prairie, a grassland. And so the idea of stewardship of the environment as we build and manage and maintain our city, relates directly to how we might think about urban forestry or how we think about green infrastructure more broadly. So we used to have lots of forests here along our ravines and along the bluffs of the Missouri River and Kansas River, and we had grasslands and oak savannas. And when we think about how we integrate a healthy environment into our city, there's all kinds of opportunities to bring a stewardship approach to restoring rivers and streams and wetlands and prairies and forests in all kinds of contextually appropriate ways.
But, Joe, can you explain the part of it that land stewardship is poorly understood in the U.S. and that its role in environmental, not just conservation, but to some extent restoration? What are you getting at there? Can you explain it?
Yeah, the role of land stewardship in helping fight climate change is poorly understood. So I think the potential for planting trees, protecting habitat, restoring habitat, being more efficient with our land management, including more efficient use of fertilizers, all of those things add up and can have a significant benefit for helping fight climate change.
But as exciting as this is, I am curious, could there be a danger in overstating the potential of planting trees in particular? Because I mean, is there a danger of people hearing this and thinking, oh, everything's going to be okay if we plant some trees? They're planting an insane amount of trees. Let's go joyriding in gas guzzlers and use a bunch of disposable plastic.
So I think that the message is that we need both planting trees and transitioning our energy economy. And transitioning the energy economy, to zero carbon energy is something that is going to take a long time and takes political effort. And planting trees is a great entry point for getting people to think about what they can personally do to help fight climate change. It's something that everyone can, everyone can help plant a tree and provide that political will and support for that. And we hope that is an entry point for people, because it's people rally behind trees. It's not a political thing. Everyone supports trees. And so it's a great way to start the conversation about what we can do as a society to help fight climate change. And but we agree it can't stop there.
You know, Tom Jacobs, I am one of the things that I like, that I think excites me and probably excites a lot of other people, is that there is something refreshing about something that you can do, and not just that, something that will be fun. And like planting a tree is fun, and it's also not something you shouldn't do, which is, there's a long list of things you shouldn't do that are part and parcel of just how we behave as a society. You know,
absolutely. It is fun. And so there is incredible urgency around dealing with the problem of climate change. And I agree with Joe completely. Anybody can plant a tree and it makes a difference. And if we plant a whole lot of trees, those benefits will become larger. And we need to consider how we manage our lands and steward our public resources, our natural resources, in different kinds of ways, and pair that up with other kinds of investments in renewable energy and energy efficiency and local food and 100 other things that are important in order to get where we need to go.
How does the vision of urban reforestation in Kansas City fit into a larger vision, for at least for you at the Mid-America Regional Council?
I think it's hard for me to paint a full picture right now. If, just beginning with the forestry piece, if we were able to increase our canopy coverage in our communities throughout the metro, it would make a demonstrable difference in terms of reducing flood risks, improving water quality, improving air quality, creating better recreational opportunities, improving habitat, improving walkability. And all those other goals are they stand alone. We want to have alternative modes of transportation. We want to be able to create affordable energy for all parts of the community. So there's lots of reasons to plant trees. We can think about that in a larger context with respect to how we manage all of our landscapes in order to increase the ecological health of those landscapes. And we can then in turn think about all of our green infrastructure and urban forestry strategies within a larger metropolitan resilience strategy so that as climate change occurs and new things are thrown our way that we haven't dealt with before, that we're better prepared to not only deal with them, but to bounce back stronger.
Yeah, resilience is different from prevention. Resilience is like, how are we going to deal with it when/if it happens?
Absolutely. And so one of the beautiful things about urban forestry is it not only is a preventive measure, but it's also a resilience measure. And so it's sort of a twofer.
Is this the season when planting trees makes sense?
Absolutely. Arbor Day is coming up. I think it's April 5th. Earth Day is April 21st, if I recall. Springtime's a great time to plant trees. And so I'd encourage all of your listeners to think about what you'd like best in your backyard. And
are there certain species of trees that you think of as being like, here in Kansas City, this is going to do well, this is going to do a lot carbon-wise, et cetera?
Oh, that we have such a diverse plant palette that folks can draw from. One of the great resources would be the Missouri Department of Conservation and the Grow Native website. They've got a lot of good stuff on there. There's whatever appeals to you, right, is a good answer.
This is KCUR Central Standard. Tom Jacobs of the Mid-America Regional Council, thank you so much. And Joe Farzioni of the Nature Conservancy, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Up next, the world premiere of a choral program at the Folly Theater this weekend. We'll hear more in just a minute.
Fighting back, getting hurt, throwing things, fighting back, getting hurt.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And this weekend, Kansas City will be home to the world premiere of an 8-piece choral performance commemorating the 50-year anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. Quiet No More will be performed by the Heartland Men's Chorus on Saturday and Sunday at the Folly Theater. 6 different composers worked on this show, and one of them is joining us from Paris this morning to talk about the significance of both the Stonewall anniversary and the musical tribute to that history. Michael Scheib, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me about the Stonewall Riots and what they mean to you.
So, at the time when they happened, I was living in, I was in Detroit. I'm from Detroit. And so I had heard little tidbits of it on the news and things that were happening. It didn't really connect with me at the time. But in retrospect, I always feel that the Stonewall Riots were basically what I would call the foundation of where we are today in this particular generation. Like, for instance, in 2011, when I married who I'm with right now, we met in grad school, and those are the kind of things that, in a way, when it happened, I was like, "Oh my God, this is crazy." It happened so fast and so furious, but when you think about it, what happened in Stonewall was sort of just the foundation of everything that occurred afterwards, leading up to things like gay marriage and other freedoms that we might enjoy at this time and not have to feel like we have to hide in the shadows like they did back in back in the 70s. And it was a very much a different time. So that's what it means to me. I even though I didn't know a whole lot about it, I do recognize the importance of what had happened on that day.
You know, as you've worked on this project, I'm guessing that you learned a lot more about the Stonewall Riots than you had previously known. And for, especially much younger listeners, can you just sort of give the basics of what that event was about, what happened?
Sure. The thing about it was, and if you look at it, it just happened. These riots happened. The police used to regularly raid the bar, and they would round up the people. And if you were, especially if you were transvestite, or you were just a man wearing women's clothes, or if you were a woman in, you know, jeans and looking very tough, they would kind of take you aside. And the other ones who were just, they would just let people go, and they would close the bar off, and they would, you know, especially the people who were, you know, dressing, cross-dressing, they would take them in, and they would, you know, it would be a very humiliating experience. And these things would happen on a regular basis. Who knows what happened that particular night? It was a very hot night in June, and at some point, it just blew up. And we might look at it and say that this was just an event that just happened, out of the blue. But in retrospect, the fuse had been lit and it was burning. And then eventually, something happened where these people were just, they just couldn't take it anymore, and so they the riot just started. Nobody really knows. Yeah, I'm sorry.
They fought back,
absolutely, and nobody really knows who started it or why or what the actual inciting event, you know, was. But it certainly was. It certainly happened, and there was a lot of things that it's pretty amazing.
How did you get involved in Quiet No More? This is the choral piece that's the world premiere happening in Kansas City this weekend, a tribute and commemoration of that history.
So years ago, I started writing for gay men's choruses with a piece called Through a Glass Darkly, which I believe Kansas had done, and at least a section of it. And so I started writing more and more for gay men's choruses. I know, you know, the choral directors, you know, Joe Nadeau and Charlie Beal. And it was really a great experience. You know, I started with the Minnesota chorus under Stan Hill. And so I got a call last year about being a part of this with the other composers that are involved. So it's been really fun to do.
You know, you have written the so-called action pieces, the parts where rioting is actually happening. And in your pieces, I understand that what you've really tried to express is the chaos of the riots. I want you to talk about that. We'll hear how you did it in a minute, but I'd like you to explain why that was important and how you pulled it off.
Well, that's good. That's a tough question. So, yes, I basically... The way that I started it was, I started the I wrote the second and the fourth piece, and I started the second piece as people who might be leaving their homes or wherever they're at to go kind of sneak downtown, to go to their favorite place to dance, to go to the thing that they kind of found to be safe and familiar and in a way, very scary, because it was there was a lot of emotion going to these places. Even when I went to any bars in Detroit to try to meet people at the time, it was a fun, exciting, but very scary thing, because sometimes they're not in the best areas. So I tried to express that as they're getting ready to go out, and then when they get there, it's like, it's just glorious. The doors open, the music's playing, people are dancing, people are very friendly to each other, and it's just a place where, of course, they wanted to be there. They were finding community. And so the way that I basically handled is that when the police arrive, things start to get a little bit out of control. And the more and more musically, it's kind of fun to do musically, because you just, at one point, we just let them, they keep repeating these things. We're not fighting back. And yeah,
we're going to hear this part. And so we'll talk about it. This is from Quiet No More, the choral program marking the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots in New York City. The premiere is going to be this weekend, and we're going to hear a little bit of the music that Michael Scheib, the composer, was just describing. Let's give this a listen.
Fighting back, getting hurt, throwing things, fighting back, getting hurt.
So this part of the song goes on a while, and I have to assume that the repetition of that line, fighting back, getting hurt, throwing things, that is part of the point?
Yes, because what follows this is I pull the music back, and we do this sort of out-of-body experience. If you've ever had something where you've been in an accident or something, and all of a sudden something's happening, but you're kind of watching what's happening from above or from another spot.
Yeah, like suddenly it's a movie.
Exactly. So these things are happening. Everything's going crazy, and all of a sudden they're looking, and these people are like, I can't believe I'm doing this. I mean, why? What's wrong? You know, I'm crazy. You know, what's wrong? What's wrong with me? Why am I doing these things? You know,
did you talk to people? Did you talk to people who had been involved in it?
No, I didn't. I just read a lot, and you know, it's interesting because things like this, on many different subjects, they sort of come out the same way when riots happen and people are unhappy what happens sort of happens the same way in many different situations. So I felt like I understood it.
You know, I'm curious what you are most proud of and how these compositions have turned out.
So, you know, what I'm really excited is to see how all of them fit together, because I'm just a part of a bigger puzzle with this piece, and the creative
team. There are
six
composers, right?
Right, exactly, and when the script came, they had prepared it so well as far as what my little chunk of section was supposed to be. They gave me everything that I needed to know about what was going on at the time in this particular section. It was very exciting. I mean, it's just to be able to write. And I'm just very proud of the way that it turned out. And I'm very happy that I got to write this section too, because I love the period music. I tried to use as much funk as I could, along with traditional sort of choral pieces. So it kind of runs in and out of these different styles to express what was going on. It really is kind of a little piece of musical theater. That's the way I look at it.
As you've gone through this process of writing your sections of this Stonewall riot commemoration, have you gone through an emotional journey with the material, with just the event itself and what it means for you in your own life and for other people in their own lives?
Yes. And it's, when you ask that question, it's funny because I live in Manhattan. I live 5 minutes away from Stonewall. So I see this dive bar all the time. I mean, it really is just a little dive bar that this happened at. And after they made it a national monument and you go by it and you start to think, as for me, as I learned more and more about what was happening with the piece, it's really something it's just amazing to see this little teeny bar have such a significance in the history of this movement.
Since you are in Paris right now, as of 2 days before this world premiere, I'm guessing you won't be here for it.
No, I've actually been in Europe for 5 weeks. I can't wait to get home. I leave back on, I return on Monday. So I will not be there, but I'll be at the New York premiere in June and possibly at the LA one. I wish I could be at all these places. I really enjoy the singers are just always so nice and kind. It's really kind of fun to come to.
I am curious what it might mean to you that it is premiering not in New York, not 5 minutes from Stonewall, but in the Midwest, where maybe the fight for equality has been a little different from the story in New York and has been playing out, I guess you could say, on a bit of a different timeline, especially for you as someone, you just said you're originally from Detroit.
Right. It is interesting that it's not premiering there, but I'm very glad it isn't. I'm very happy for the people of Kansas to be able to hear this piece, because I think it does. See, it's funny because in New York, we don't have the same. I don't think we have a lot of the same worries. I'm not saying that it doesn't exist, because it does. When there are people that kind of get, you know, beat up, or problems that happen on the, you know, late night. But it is a different thing. It's a different thing because I feel like certainly in more rural areas, a lot of people, until they know someone who they care about, and or who they don't care, but they just know someone, a lot of the problems come because people don't really know, at least in the past, they didn't know someone who was gay or lesbian or what, you know. And there's a lot of new things that have come out that have. It's hard. I'm not being very.
No, you're doing fine.
I just think that the problem that happens in the rural areas are a lot different than they are in the cities, just in the sense that there's fear of it that's flamed, and when you start to get to know someone, you're just like, they're just like everyone else, you know. We want the same things, and I think that's what's nice when these pieces start to get put out there. Then people kind of understand a little bit more of the history of what was going on.
What do you hope people come away from Quiet No More either understanding or doing or just feeling?
You know, for me, it is a feeling thing. It's and understanding. I, like you had said, there's a lot of younger people who really don't even know what happened, and that is a really good thing to understand what the history is that allowed you to be who you are today, to go out in public and not to go out in fear, and to have people around you that care about you. I think that's really important. I mean, this was really definitely the start, at least in my opinion, is the start of all of that.
The start of what we would call the LGBTQIA movement. And
yes.
A lot of those letters have been added recently to that term.
But. Yeah. Yes. And yes, indeed. And I think people don't want to be thrown into a classification that they might not feel that they belong to, you know, or to belong in. So, yes.
We played a clip earlier from one of the pieces that you did. Can you tell us a little bit about the other piece that we didn't hear before we go?
Sure. So the first thing when I opened the when I wrote the opener, that basically introduces it's more of an ethereal piece that they have pre-recorded people that they've interviewed that have said a lot of certain phrases about what they thought about Stonewall, what they knew, what they didn't know, the things that were true, the things were not true. It's a really interesting thing that they did above a piece of music that I've written for that. And that music is basically taken from parts 2 and 4. Part 2 is the start where we start to go to the bar, and there's a raid, but it was basically the first raid so that we can set up
a police
the
raid.
Things Right, exactly. Right, and it's the first raid, so we set it up so that you can see that these things happened, that they just shut the door. It's just usual. It's business as usual. That's what part 2 is. Then part 4 is just something lit. After the same thing happens, something's lit. People go into chaos, and the rest is history.
Well, Michael Scheib, thank you so much for talking to us today from Paris. I know it's much later there than it is here.
Well, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate it. And thank you.
Michael Scheib is one of the composers behind Quiet No More, a choral tribute to the anniversary of the Stonewall riots that happened in 1969. It'll be 50 years since that historic moment in June, and the Heartland Men's Chorus will perform the world premiere this weekend at the Folly Theater. You can get more show info at follytheater.org/events. That's a wrap for today's show. We've talked about activism past and present with conversations about the Stonewall riots of the 20th century and the people currently hitting their breaking point when it comes to fighting climate change. You can grab both of those conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow is a food show about the chicken and the egg. We're putting the egg first. That's just us. Call in with your favorite chicken dish on a Kansas City menu, or you can start tweeting your recommendations now at KCUR CST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.